Allison Flowers has a terrific new book out called The Exoneree Diaries, The Fight for Innocence, Independence, and Identity. And she'll be in St. Louis tonight doing a book signing at Left Bank Books at 7 o'clock. But before that, I've invited her to join me here this afternoon. Allison, welcome to the Big 550.
Thank you so much for having me.
The book is full of stories about four people who were wrongly convicted and in some cases spent decades in jail before being released and becoming free people once again. Is there a thread connecting the four of them?
There is. There's this whole sense of being burdened. The word exoneree, first of all, is not a word. It's not one that I've been able to find in any dictionary, but we decided to put it in the title of my book because, we're aware of this community of people leaving prison that are innocent of the crimes that sent them there. And an exoneration happens every 3 days in the U.S., although, that's still a pretty rare thing. But the word, to exonerate means to be unburdened. And it's, sort of a misnomer. These people leaving prison are very burdened by the tragedy of being wrongly convicted, the trauma of incarceration, and then having to rebuild their lives on the outside is no easy task. There's sort of this media myth that release from prison is a happy Hollywood ending, and it's not an ending at all. It's really just the beginning of another set of struggles for these four people that I profile in my book.
So they have to come to terms with their freedom. They probably have to get a job. They got to put their lives back together. They have to deal with technology. If you've been in prison 20 years, you probably didn't have a cell phone when you went in, and now the whole world is cell phones.
Exactly. I'm on one right now, actually. And, when you walk out of prison as an exoneree, you don't receive any compensation, no matter where you are. That's something that you have to seek, and it depends on what state that you live in, and it's a separate legal process, normally by which you have to prove your innocence to a court in order to receive any money. And then even then, if you are successful, you may not get very much money. In Illinois, where much of the book focuses, the most you can get, no matter how long you were behind bars, is $200,000. So there, you don't get a dime in your pocket when you leave prison on a wrongful conviction. And hopefully there's someone there to get you, because you don't even get a bus pass. There aren't any social services. There's no counseling, no medical. And worse than that, your record is not automatically expunged, so you can't find work very easily. So the technology piece is totally part of it. I mean, you're looking at an iPad and iPhones, and, you don't understand that email is on the phone and you can navigate on the phone and all these things. And, technology for us creates this illusion of ease, but for an exoneree, it actually makes the world more difficult to navigate.
I have to go back to something very important that you said in there. You have to prove your innocence. Weren't you just released because the society determined that you were wrongfully convicted and therefore you are innocent? Why would you have to then further prove your innocence?
Exactly. Well, and that is part of what exonerees experience, is they live behind this veil of suspicion for the rest of their lives, because there's this misconception that, oh, you just beat your case, you got out of prison on a legal technicality. And there's no way for the court right now to signal that this case has been overturned on new evidence and this person is actually innocent and we're declaring this person innocent. Really, convictions get overturned, they get thrown out, people get released, and then they're never retried again. There's all these sorts of gray areas where, community doesn't necessarily trust these people, even if it was very strong evidence of innocence that released them from prison in the first place. So depending on where you live, 30 states compensate exonerees, so there's still, and D.C., there's still 20 states that do not. So if you live in one of those 30 states, you can seek compensation again. You have to have a lawyer to help you. You have to petition the court. And like you said, proving innocence is a difficult thing to do. It's in many ways a higher standard of proof than it took to originally convict you. So, originally to convict, you have to have, it's guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. And your defense attorney is just proving that you actually has no burden of proof, but if they take that upon themselves, they're just there to show that you're not guilty. But proving innocence is hard. I mean, especially after a long incarceration, when evidence that could clear you has been destroyed, perhaps, or people that could clear you by testifying may have died. So it's another burden that gets added to the many burdens that exonerees experience.
After these people who have been wrongly convicted are exonerated and let out of jail, do they still have to check the box on job applications that says, check here if you've been convicted of a felony or a crime?
Well, I mean, it's a complicated matter. I think that, you know, have they ever? Yes. There's no box for the wrongly convicted, right? And so one of the people in my book, his name is James Kleppelberg. He was a handyman who was wrongly convicted of 6 arson murders and was serving 6 life sentences when he was released. And he applied for hundreds of jobs, and he put his wrongful conviction up at the top of his resume that he would send out because he wanted to be very clear with people about his work experience, which he didn't get much of behind bars, that made him qualified for a number of positions, but he also wanted it to be clear why he wasn't going to pass a background check. He had great letters of recommendations from, you know, the lawyers who had helped him and believed in his innocence and everything. But, you know, he showed up for a job interview one day, and the person said, you know, sorry, we don't hire convicted murderers, when she ran his background check. You know, clearly she hadn't looked at the first thing on his resume. And so, yeah, that's something that they feel very torn about what to do. Do I disclose this? Do I not disclose this? And I think every exoneree kind of decides something a little different for their situation. Generally, the counsel that they get from people is to go ahead and be upfront about it. It's better for it to come out, you know, first thing than to come out later. And then, you know, sometimes the lawyers who help them are able to pull some connections and help them find work. But it's not an easy task. And, you know, beyond that, it depends on what the job is. One of the exonerees in my book, she's a one-woman exoneree. She was able to, through, you know, some help, get a job at a casino where she was doing security. So she's gone from prison, where she's getting the pat-down, to running security at a casino where she's getting the pat-down. And that was very traumatic for her to have to relive that. And she, you know, eventually had to quit that job because it was too much for her to handle. So, you know, there's a lot of areas like that where exonerees just, you know, experience so much trauma just trying to rebuild their life.
I'll tell you what got me about that woman's story. Her name is Christine Bunch, who you write about in the Exoneree Diaries. The part of her story that got me is that she got pregnant before she went to prison. She was awaiting trial for an arson murder that she did not commit. And by the time she finally got out, exonerated for having not committed that crime, her son was already a teenager.
Right.
Does she have any kind of bond with him at all?
It's very strained, and you know that's the particular tragedy that exonerees face when their parents and, you know, husbands and wives going into the system, is that they lose those bonds with their kids no matter how hard they try. Prison is not designed to support families. It's designed to separate you and to keep you locked out from them. And you know that obviously for the larger prison population is a huge determinant in their you know, whether or not they reoffend and that sort of thing. Of course, exonerees didn't offend in the first place. But for Christine, you know, as being a woman exoneree, women really face that unique set of challenges. She was wrongly convicted of arson murder, but it was for the death of her son, a 3-year-old who died in a trailer fire. She did get pregnant with another son before going into prison. But, you know, she had to deliver him while she was in prison at a hospital in a very emergency situation, which is very traumatic. Normally they shackle women for that process because she was having a cesarean section. The surgeon did not allow shackles in his operating room. Otherwise, she may have been shackled while delivering her baby. I'm almost 8 months pregnant with my first child, so that, you know, strikes a particular chord with me.
Yep.
But yes, you know, coming out, her son was very distant, very scared that she would actually have to go back. Even though very strong evidence overturned her case by the Supreme Court of Indiana, there was still a chance that the court could retry her because the Supreme Court sent it back to the lower court. And so she still lives with that hanging over her head. I mean, I think given all the media attention and hopefully with this book, it's very unlikely that they would retry her or try to. But that's not something that you can necessarily explain to a 17-year-old who is finally has his mother back, who he never really knew, and now she's trying to be a mom to him and tell him what to do. I mean, they experienced a lot of growing pains in her first year out, and now even to this day, it's really hard for them to maintain a relationship. And beyond that, as a woman, you know, she lost many of her years of fertility. A huge part of her story in the book is her quest for fertility. and trying to have a child of her own so that she could raise a child of her own, which she missed out on twice in her life.
Allison, you've worked on lots of these stories, going back to your years at Northwestern's Medill Justice Project, and you worked on a lot of potentially wrongful conviction cases. I'm curious, in these five-plus years that you've been working on such stories and those that you write about in the book, what you've learned about the unreliability of eyewitness testimony and forensic science, et cetera.
Well, luckily we know from tracking exonerations, the court has no way to track exonerations. You know, the courts are too divided and everyone follows a different set of rules. There's no, like, newsletter or alert that goes out when someone has been exonerated or when charges have been cleared or anything like that. Luckily, there's some great researchers at the University of Michigan who have something called the National Registry of Exonerations, and that tracks all exonerations going back to 1989, all that are known, I should say. So there are more than 1,800 that we know of. Of course, there's probably so many that have slipped between the cracks. But the benefit of tracking these is that we can look at the cases themselves and know what the contributing factors were to the wrongful conviction in the first place. And you mentioned eyewitness misidentification, which is certainly one of the leading contributing causes. I think it's about a quarter of cases involve that. And that's very hard evidence for a jury to overcome in a trial, is when someone is saying, I saw this person do this, and they're pointing to them in court. We all think that our memory and our eyeballs are infallible. But I've taken, little tests to see how I would perform as an eyewitness, and I have failed miserably. So eyewitness testimony is just very unreliable. But actually, the two leading causes of wrongful convictions that we see in these exonerations are maybe not what folks would suspect, and that's perjury or false accusations. So someone basically lying about you in court, accusing you of something that you didn't do, that is the number one reason that people are wrongly convicted, and you see that throughout the cases in my book. But the second cause is official misconduct. So that could be police, that could be prosecutors having tunnel vision or sticking to a theory of the crime or hiding evidence, destroying evidence, not disclosing evidence to the defense. All those things would fall under the category of official misconduct. And that accounts for a lot of wrongful convictions, more than half.
And do exonerees have any legal recourse against the prosecutors and police who put them away wrongly?
Well, suing the city or police department successfully is pretty rare. Of course, that's what we hear about in the headlines, right, when someone, after a wrongful conviction, gets a multimillion-dollar settlement. But those are actually won by the very few. Very few cases are well-suited for civil litigation, and proving official misconduct, even though it's present, like I said, in more than half of exonerations, is difficult. In Chicago, we now have a way to track and look at police misconduct complaints for a certain set of years, and we know that 97% of Chicago police misconduct complaints go undisciplined. So if we're letting almost all police officers act with a certain level of impunity and they're not receiving consequences for their misconduct, I mean, what do you think that means for people who are wrongly convicted? I think there are, many false arrests, many evidence planting situations. That's what we saw in Making a Murderer, which sort of popularized the notion of an exoneree. I think the whole country was shocked that there would be this level of misconduct in a case. And, when I watched that, I thought, well, this is something that I see every day. This isn't rare at all. And that's what people really need to understand, is that wrongful convictions can and do happen to ordinary people just like you and me. Christine didn't even have so much of a parking ticket on her record when she was wrongly convicted for the death of her son. The investigators immediately suspected her, and they, zeroed in on her while she was being treated for her own injuries from the fire at the hospital within hours of her son's death, and that's when they tape recorded her first interrogation. So there's a lot that needs to be done, actually, by way of tackling the issue of police misconduct. And I think that will greatly reduce wrongful convictions, as well as getting rid of the gamesmanship that we see in court with prosecutors, where they want to win rather than get it right.
I've only got another minute left here, but I have to ask you, how much is money a factor? Do rich people go to jail for crimes they didn't commit?
I do think that socioeconomics play a huge role in wrongful convictions. We see inadequate legal defenses as being a strong contributing factor to whether or not someone is able to prove their innocence the first time around. However, I still would say that wrongful convictions happen to anybody. Social status doesn't always protect you. Money doesn't always protect you. I do think it helps to have money when you're fighting a conviction behind bars to be able to hire people to work in your defense and help prove your innocence on appeal. So money plays a role, but we do see wrongful convictions against every class, mm-hmm. every race. Of course, wrongful convictions do disproportionately affect people of color.
Right.
So that's a very important part of the equation.
Okay.
But I think the takeaway is that it can happen to anyone.
The book is called Exoneree Diaries, The Fight for Innocence, Independence, and Identity. Allison Flowers will be talking about it and signing books that you buy tonight at Left Bank Books at 7 o'clock. Thanks for joining me here today, Allison, and good luck with the baby.
Thanks so much. Take care.
I'm Paul Harris. This is the Big 550 KTRS.